This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us on our Main Street across the state this time of day. And of course, on our Main Streets this time of day, we hope people are talking about our $5,000 giving day. We have until 6 today, Central Time, to get your gift matched dollar for dollar thanks to $5,000 in matching money courtesy of the M. Gene Fisher Donor Advised Fund. We'll talk about that more later in our Main Street show today. But this is also the time of year when people might say, a new broom sweeps clean. This calendar year is drawing to a close, of course, and much of what made it challenging will spill into 2019. The 116th Congress will convene in early January, and one of the new members will be Representative-elect Kelly Armstrong, who will join Senator-elect Kevin Cramer in what is likely to be a tumultuous, possibly historic political year. Armstrong will be John Harris's guest this Friday on Prairie Pulse, and today we'll start our show with an excerpt of their conversation.
Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And, of course, that's representative to the U.S. Congress newly elected. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, as we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background and maybe where you're originally from.
Yeah, I grew up in Dickinson. I live there now. I spent 10 years in Grand Forks, moved back to Dickinson in 2006. I went to law school at UND, met my wife, who is from Oslo, Norway. She was an exchange student there. We have a lovely daughter, Anna, a great son, Eli, and my dad's been in the oil and gas industry since before I was born. So in about 2012, I got a little sick of guys in black robes controlling my calendar, so I went, and my dad was spending more time at the lake, so I went to work for his company. Ran for the state Senate, got elected until very recently, served as the chair of the Judiciary Committee, served on the Natural Resources Committee, chaired the Justice Reinvestment Committee, and served on the Administrative Rules Committee in the interim. I'm former state party chairman of the North Dakota Republican Party, and in February of this year, we got in the House race, and it's been off to the races.
Can you talk about the process that you're currently been going through sort of in getting acclimated to the transition to Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, you know, we've done 2 weeks of orientation out in D.C., and that's really a high-level, the best analogy I can give is a high-level freshman orientation at college. I mean, but instead of talking about dorm rooms and textbooks, you're talking about cybersecurity and federal payroll and benefits to help with your staff. And at the same time, we're working on transition here in North Dakota. I think eventually we will want 4 offices here. We're trying to get our Fargo office set up, our Bismarck office set up, and then we'll work towards Grand Forks and Minot. And at the same time, making sure we hire people that know North Dakota and are working forward to making sure these issues are coming forward.
You know, when you ran, of course, the House was controlled by the Republican Party. Were you anticipating being in the minority when you ran?
Yeah, I think, not necessarily anticipating it, but we all, I mean, midterm elections for president, traditionally, historically, have not always gone well for the party in power. So, I mean, that wasn't really a decision we made. We made the decision to run as because we thought we had the best message and we have the best team to represent the state.
Mm-hmm. Of course, speaking to that, you know, how do you think you're going to work with it? You touted yourself as being able to work across the aisle.
Yeah, and even now when they're in the minority, I'll say the same thing. Bipartisanship for the sake of bipartisanship isn't always good. There are huge philosophical differences between the Republicans and the Democrats, and it's good to have those debates. What I hope to bring down there is 2 things. One, I've done a good job in North Dakota of building coalitions, you know, as the prime sponsor of the surge funding bill and working through that. I mean, convincing eastern legislators sometimes that the western part of the state was really in dire straits for infrastructure was tough. And then 2, I've always had the ability to fight with somebody about issue A at 1 o'clock and work with them on issue B at 1:30. And that's what you have to do. I don't have a delegation. We're an at-large congressional district. So in order to move issues forward, you have to be able to fight when it's appropriate and work with those same people when it's appropriate then.
What do you see as the biggest challenges that you'll face as you go to D.C.?
Yeah, well, the majority in Congress controls the agenda, so I think the biggest challenge will be able to see how we can work some things through that are important in North Dakota that might not always align, particularly with the national Democrats and what's important here. I think global warming and those issues will start coming up, and they'll possibly come up from more of an ideological stance than necessarily a sound public policy stance. My concern with those is always the first three industries that go into the crosshairs is ag, coal, and oil. Well, I'm not sure there are three more important industries to North Dakota than ag, coal, and oil. In fact, I know they're not. So we'll be there advocating to make sure that we're dealing with those things.
Do you have any indication of what committees you'll serve on, or which ones would you like to serve on?
Yeah, I mean, eventually we'd like to see energy and commerce, agriculture, obviously, to go back to their anchor tenants, they're important, but transportation and infrastructure, obviously I have a background in judiciary, government oversight, natural resources. With Congress switching from Republican control to Democratic control right now, I'm not even sure they know the size of the committees right now, so that process will work itself through in the next couple weeks.
Sure. Before we came on the air here, we were talking about your family, but what kind of adjustments will your family have to make, and what's going to happen?
My wife actually will tell you I'll probably be home as much or more now, and there's more structure to it, right? When they're in session, you're in D.C., you come home on the weekends. My kids will continue to go to school in Dickinson. They've been fantastic through this whole campaign, but like after Christmas, we get sworn in January 3rd, which is actually my anniversary, mine and my wife's anniversary, and my parents' anniversary. So after Christmas, we're going to go down to D.C. and we're going to spend New Year's down there and go through the inauguration process just so my kids get acclimated to all the things that are available, and so they know, they understand it as a place where dad works and not just a concept.
Sure. And the age of your kids, Washington, D.C. is a great place to be.
My daughter probably, by the time a lot of your viewers come down to visit our office, may be giving the best Capitol tour of anybody. So it's going to be really exciting for them, and it's exciting. And I need them to be a part of it. I mean, we ran on this. We ran as a family. We did that. And they're my best supporters, and they're still my number one, two, and three constituent, not in any particular order.
Well, good. Well, let's get into some of the issues, I guess. Let's talk about, what are your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act, and of course, which is a lawsuit in the state of North Dakota, and the efforts to repeal the law?
Yeah, I mean, as things move through the court system, they're going to do that, but we are going to have a divided Congress, and healthcare was a big issue, not just in North Dakota, but it was all across the country. So there are reforms that have to happen. The current, regardless of what happens in the legal system, Congress needs to work, primarily in rural areas. I mean, that's what is important. Our rural hospitals are the way we do things. I will always advocate for more state control. I've said this in the campaign, and I'll say it every day in Washington, D.C. I trust Governor Burgum and John Gottfried to deal with the healthcare challenges in North Dakota significantly more than I trust the federal government. So we need to keep working towards maintaining cost, increasing coverage, and getting better healthcare, particularly in rural areas, because that's an area where costs continue to go up, and it's unsustainable on its current path.
Okay. Switch to trade war. What about the trade war, the impact on North Dakota farmers? How do you see some of this playing out?
Yeah, you know, the president was just recently in Argentina, and they signed the USMCA, or as I refer to it, the new NAFTA, but which is positive. It's just a grain grading situation alone is a tremendous benefit to North Dakota grain producers. As we talk right now, there's a 90-day timeline set with China. Egg products and automobile products are a big part of that conversation. So I'm hopeful but not naive, but we need to continue to work through those things, and we need to get some trade resolutions taken care of.
Okay. How do you plan to combat sort of gridlock in Washington?
Yeah, well, I'm one out of 435 in the House. I'm one out of 535 to begin with. I think that's exciting, primarily with the freshmen coming into Congress, is that there are a lot of combat vets on both sides of the aisle, and I notice it a lot because I've never served. So, the sacrifices they've made even before they got elected to Congress are just it's unimaginable, and we wouldn't have our freedoms without them. So I think there's some areas where we can work together. The other answer I think that's important is of the 37 people who are currently running for Democrat or running for president on the Democratic side, most of them are in D.C. And we've all seen this in elections. You have to be able to run on something and not just against something. So I think infrastructure is an area where we may be able to get something together and get some bipartisan support. And I think continuing on the opioid addiction crisis across this country, you know, they passed the largest opioid bipartisan opioid legislation in our history, and they did it right in the middle of the Kavanaugh hearing, so nobody heard about it. But there is still bipartisan things that move forward. And I think the ability to work with people on issues like that that are important and important to North Dakota citizens is how you do it.
Mm-hmm. What about your views on President Trump and, you know, when to support the president and when not to, depending on specific legislation?
Yeah, and I think you take whatever is coming out of the president's office as on a case-by-case basis. I will say, by and large, that this president has and his staff have spent more time in North Dakota than probably the last five presidents combined, and seems to care about the heartland issues, whether it's ag, whether it's energy. You know, North Dakota is not a sleepy flyover state anymore. We are an economic powerhouse, not just in this country, but nationally, whether it's ag, whether it's oil, whether it's the second largest Microsoft campus in the country, or the largest one outside of Washington, you know, our unmanned aircraft technology up in Grand Forks. These are issues that don't just affect North Dakota, they affect the whole country. But you work with the president because, by and large, his policies have been great for North Dakota, and when you disagree with him, you do it, but you do it in a respectful manner, and you advocate for the citizens of North Dakota, and that's my job, and that's what it will always be. And I'll agree with Democrats if it's good for North Dakota, and I'll disagree with the president if it's bad for North Dakota.
Well, going back to some of the issues, you know, the House may start some investigations, at least that's what some outlets are saying, into the Trump administration, and the Mueller investigation appears to be winding down. Can you talk about your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think Mueller should finish his investigation. I think he should be allowed to finish his investigation, but I also think it does need to wrap up here fairly shortly. I mean, the country needs to move on from that. And as far as investigations go, valid investigations, working forward to find answers to things. Every administration goes through this. When the other party holds either chamber of Congress, there tend to be more. That's just part of the way it works. But these can't turn into partisan witch hunts. I mean, I watched the first 2 days of the Kavanaugh hearing, and I don't think anybody who's really interested in getting to the truth, I think they were auditioning for a 2020 presidential run. So I'm hopeful that we can work forward and do these in a professional manner and move them forward. But we will defend the process and we will work for it.
Okay. Let's talk about things you've already mentioned, though, the energy and oil and how they fit into North Dakota's economy. Well, really going forward, and what's your thoughts more and more detail on that?
Yeah, and I think that's one area where national policy can really have an impact in North Dakota, and oftentimes it's not a positive impact, and it's not just the oil and gas industry, it's also the agriculture industry. You know, when you're dealing with federal lands, federal regulations, they don't discriminate from what business you're doing. But what we have found in North Dakota, both, and we've heard this in state Senate hearings, I've heard it in my personal life, I've heard it in my professional life, is the federal government involved in these types of policies doesn't make the environment any cleaner, it doesn't make it any safer. What it does do is take more time and cost more money. And so we have a great and robust regulatory system here in North Dakota, and we need to be work in D.C. to policies that allow those decisions to come back home.
Yeah. Recently, the governor presented his budget that, of course, the legislature will take up in North Dakota. But a lot of that, has federal tax dollars attached with it. How important is it for you to help continue that?
Absolutely. Whether it's the Fargo-Moorhead diversion, whether it's the Souris River flood control, whether it's transportation budget. You know, one thing we've seen in North Dakota is the portion of money we get from the federal government to do infrastructure packages has continued to go down, which means North Dakota citizens are paying more, and we're fine with that. But we're a commodity-based economy. We have to have markets for our products, and we have to have the infrastructure to move our products. And we also need to be able to work at the federal level to ensure that we can move our products to port and not just get them out of the state. So there's a lot of issues that we have to deal with. Obviously, the federal government has a huge role, and we'll be advocating for those issues because they're important to our economy.
Yeah. What is the status of the Farm Bill negotiations?
Farm Bill, it's I'm sounds like it's going to get done in the lame duck. And Colin Peterson from Minnesota has been working hard to get that done. Right now, I believe the CBO is rescoring it because there were some minor changes. But, you know, that was one thing. When we were in D.C. the first week for orientation, nobody was very optimistic it was going to get done. By the time we got there for our second week right after Thanksgiving, everybody was very optimistic that it's going to get done. And it really is important. You know, where we farm 6 miles south of Richardton in western North Dakota. And not this summer, but last summer was the worst drought in a generation out there. So we saw all of the factors in place, combined with low commodity prices and trade uncertainty. We need to ensure that we have a five-year farm bill with the safety nets that our farmers and ranchers depend on to get through some issues they need.
Well, let's go back to another point here that's been in the news a lot. What about your views on immigration and things going on kind of near the border?
Yeah, we need, just with the military deployment down there and now an extension and how all of these things come, I think we've come to a conclusion that the situation down there borders on ridiculous most of the time. We need to build the wall, and it's important in North Dakota for a lot of different reasons. This immigration debate has become so toxic that we can't have conversations about legal immigration that is needed here. We have 30,000 open jobs, and we need to work through it. As said earlier, my wife's from Oslo, Norway. Nobody's a bigger fan of legal immigration than I am. But we need to be able to solve some of these workforce challenges, and legal immigration has to be a part of that conversation. It doesn't matter if you talk to a trucking company, oil and gas company, construction company. They're looking for skilled and unskilled workforce, and immigration has to be a part of that conversation. But I don't think we move any of those balls forward until we have a safe and secure border.
Mm-hmm. What about your view on foreign policy and where you see the United States sort of fitting into the world?
Yeah, and that's one of the things I always say is we need to be secure in our borders and global in our thinking. And a lot of what we're dealing with these trade disputes right now has been dealing with some recentering some lopsided agreements. But we always do better when we're the world's only superpower, and we need to be the shining light on the top of the hill that other people can look to and need to work forward in those issues. And you know, when it comes to different places where we have potential theaters of conflict and different areas, I'm skilled in a lot of things and I have a lot of background experience, but those are areas where we will get briefed continually in DC, and every day we need to be learning about how our military is interacting with the rest of the world, how our country is interacting with the rest of the world, and work to continue to make sure we are doing those things properly.
Mm-hmm. If people want more information, where will your offices be in North Dakota, and how can they get in contact with you?
Yeah, our state director will be based out of Fargo. We're working on setting up a Fargo office, a Bismarck office. We will have a Grand Forks office. We will have a presence in Minot. How we do it now, we'll work on. And a lot of this depends on the people we hire and how we want to interact with those things. You know, we'll have those anchor offices, but the world's getting... we're dealing with things differently. I mean, I want the people that work for me, if they're sitting in their office from 8 to 5, they're not doing their job. We need to be out. We need to be in the communities. We need to be in the neighboring communities and finding out what's going on in D.C. that's affecting people on the ground. So we're working towards that. Again, we're gonna take this slow. We're going to hire the right people. We're going to get this set up the right way. I think sometimes, especially when you're doing something brand new, if you're in too much of a hurry, you can make a mistake. And so we want to make sure we have the right people that will best serve the North Dakota citizens.
Well, I guess I'd give you just a brief moment here. What would you like to say to the citizens of North Dakota?
If you have an issue, please contact us. Please contact any of our offices as we get set up. I'm going to be down there every day working as hard as I can to make sure we're advocating for issues that help the state.
Well, Kelly, good luck to you, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
Kelly Armstrong will represent North Dakota in the next Congress. He spoke with our John Harris. You can see Prairie Pulse on our television service this Friday evening at 7:30 Central. Coming up on Main Street, Mark Trahan comments on the White House investigations.
There are many ways to be a leader. Some run big companies. Some serve on the school board or volunteer for causes they care about. Most leaders are regular people who want to make a difference. They do it by supporting what matters to them. I'm Tamara Keith. When you give to public radio, you're supporting reliable journalism. So please, follow your heart and be a leader. Make a year-end gift now.
Make your year-end tax-deductible gift to Prairie Public by calling 800-359-4145, going to prairiepublic.org, or by texting the word SUPPORT to 484848 and click on the link.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's 5K Giving Day. This is your opportunity to match your donation, your support to Prairie Public, dollar for dollar, thanks to the M. Gene Fisher Donor Advised Fund. It's easy to do. You just pick up the phone, dial us toll-free, 800-359-4145, or you can go online to prairiepublic.org, or you can text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and click on the link we send to you. So we hope you'll do one of those things, because we always appreciate the fact that you're listening. But the fact of the matter is, members make it possible to listen. And you can think of how much your generous gift can mean to Prairie Public when it is matched dollar for dollar. That is making the most. That's leveraging your support for Prairie Public. And, of course, it's the end of the year. It's a time when maybe you hear lots of appeals, and you may be out buying presents and doing all that kind of thing, too. But, no, think of this service that you've been using all year. If you're a listener, and many of you are, that's why you're listening, I hope, because Main Street provides something that you can't get elsewhere. It's an original show. It's produced by Prairie Public, and we have a small group of people who work very hard to make this show as special as we can be every day from 3 to 4 Central Time here on Prairie Public. So make that call. Take advantage of 5K Giving Day. Give us a call, 800-359-4145, online at prairiepublic.org, or text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and click on the link we send. And for those of you who've done that, thank you very much. Well, this year we've seen politics and the law collide in a way that is disconcerting to many and threatening to some. The federal budget is still not set, and in weeks a new Congress will take office, but the old one still has the power, and there are criminal inquiries involving the President of the United States. Mark Trahant offers a commentary.
Congress has until December 21st to enact a spending bill for several federal agencies, including the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service. If not, there will be a limited government shutdown right around the holidays. This needs to be the last act of a Congress that's soon to leave office, or if it's a mess, it could be the first act of a new Congress that takes office in January. What makes this challenge even more complex is the legal situation of Donald J. Trump. Federal prosecutors have now publicly alleged that the president, known as Individual One, engaged in criminal activity. The key documents come from two legal channels, filings by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, as well as additional filings by the U.S. Justice Department prosecutors representing the Southern District of New York. One of the documents is a sentencing memo for Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. Quote, "The defendant's crime was serious," reports the memo. "Defendant admitted he told these lies, which he publicly and in submission to Congress, in order to minimize the links between the Moscow Project and Individual One and give the false impression that the Moscow Project had ended before the Iowa caucus and the first presidential primaries, in hopes of limiting the ongoing Russia investigations. In particular, as Cohen himself has now admitted, with respect to both payments, he acted in coordination with and at the direction of Individual One," prosecutor said. As Dana Milbank wrote in the Washington Post, "Individual One has a singular problem. His own Justice Department has just said he directed a crime." President Trump does not see the story this way. He told reporters over the weekend that he had not read the documents, but that he's been cleared of collusion. "There is a lot we still do not know. These documents were heavily redacted, and this part of the investigation has a limited scope. But the criminal process has now begun to unfold in a public manner. At some point, likely soon, Mueller will bring the investigation to a close. The next step could be a public report outlining the criminal activity of Trump. To use the Watergate-era phrase, the potential of an unindicted co-conspirator. That route would leave open the possibility of criminal charges after the president leaves office or impeachment proceedings in the Congress. A second option, a controversial one, is for the president to be charged with crimes while in office. Legal scholars even disagree about whether that's constitutional." I'm Mark Trahant.
Mark Trahant is the editor of Indian Country Today. Coming up on Main Street, we'll share an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast about improving the classroom experience for teachers and students. First, a news update with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp gave her farewell speech on the Senate floor today. In her speech, she recounted some of her legislative victories, but she also had some advice for her colleagues and the new members who will take their seats in January. She called for bipartisan solutions to big problems.
Everyone in Congress makes their own decisions about how you want to use your time, and it can come down to a few simple questions. Do you want to solve problems or not? Do you want to do right by your children and your grandchildren? And that means all of our children and our grandchildren. Do you want to win a re-election at no matter what the cost? Do you want to be able to look yourself in the mirror and say, I did good today? I implore those still serving and about those about to join this chamber to seriously examine those questions.
After she spoke, colleagues like Senator John Hoeven, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, and Maine Senator Susan Collins spoke favorably of her service in the Senate. Congressional leaders have released a compromise farm bill that one of the Senate's few farmers will not be supporting. Here's Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer.
Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley has received farm support payments, but he's long pushed for tighter rules that would restrict them to active participants in the farm's management. For the third farm bill in a row, his Senate colleagues supported restrictions, but the final bill left them out. So Grassley told reporters he will vote no, and he blames Southern politicians, including the House Agriculture Committee Chairman Mike Conaway of Texas.
He comes from a part of agriculture where the culture of that agriculture is dependency on the government, and he backs that sort of an approach.
Grassley applauded Kansas Senator Pat Roberts' efforts to reach a compromise and says the lack of payment limits is his only disappointment. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And North Dakota's only full-time federal judge says he will go into semi-retirement next year. Chief U.S. District Judge Dan Hovland says he wrote a letter informing President Trump that he plans to take senior status on his 65th birthday.
My intention is to continue to carry a fairly full-time caseload. We've got a pretty significant backlog of both criminal and civil cases right now in the district. And I've been the only federal judge in North Dakota since late September of 2017, I believe, when Judge Ralph Erickson was elevated to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals.
Hovland's departure creates a second vacancy on the federal bench in North Dakota. Hovland says he is hopeful that both positions can be filled before he steps away next November. Hovland was nominated to the federal bench by President George W. Bush in 2002. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
In an era where fake news and alternative facts often get more attention than actual facts, you need a news source that's proved itself to be trustworthy. But what does trust look like and what does it sound like? Hi, I'm Mara Liasson. Building a rapport and trust takes time. In news, it also means being transparent, reporting the facts, and taking full responsibility for your stories. Relationship building is especially important in public radio because you, our listeners, are at the center of our work. Informing you is the reason we exist as a news network. You value news that's independent and unbought. That's the relationship you have with public radio. So show your trust in us as 2018 comes to a close and make a year-end gift.
Make your year-end tax-deductible gift to Prairie Public by calling 800-359-4145, going to prairiepublic.org, or by texting the word SUPPORT to 484848 and click on the link.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, the host of the show you're listening to right now. And it's a pleasure to have you with us always, listening to Main Street and maybe finding out something you hadn't known before or being entertained in a way you hadn't been entertained before. And as you were just reminded, 2018 is drawing to a close. There are only 20 days left in this year. And that's why we're calling today 5K Giving Day. That's because M. Gene Fisher made it possible for us to have a $5,000 matching fund today to encourage you to give. If you're a listener and you have never given before, this is a golden opportunity because your donation, your support, becomes doubled It's dollar for dollar, matched, and it's easy to do. 800-359-4145 is the toll-free number to call, or prairiepublic.org online. Or if you've got that smartphone, just text the word support to 484848 and click on the link we send. You know, we offer Tom Ezern's Plainsfolk essays here, Madeline's movie reviews, and he's got a lot at the end of the year like we have these days, and Sue Balcom's fun food feature. We call it Main Street Eats, and of course, we've got that North Dakota news and political coverage that you have come to expect from Prairie Public. Well, take advantage of our 5K giving day. Give us a call, go online, or text the word support to 484848. And for those of you who've done that, thank you. The Cutting Ed podcast is back for a second season on Prairie Public, and today we share an excerpt from host Tom Gerhardt's visit with Heidi Demars, who works with teachers and schools across the state as part of her Mindful You, Mindful Me practice. In this episode, Heidi explains how mindfulness can improve emotional health classroom performance with host Tom Gerhardt.
I wanted to ask, how did you come into this work, and why does it matter to you?
Yeah, so I started as an occupational therapist working in the schools, and I stumbled upon a boy one day who was just really struggling. He wasn't picking up his pencil. He wasn't making eye contact. I knew something had happened, but he wasn't willing to share that with me. And so on the weekends, I was teaching kids yoga, and a part of that is breathing practices, calming practices, where we really focused on self-regulation, emotional balance. And I thought, well, I'm just going to do one of those practices with him today. And we're going to scrap the handwriting for now. Something was clearly wrong, but I had a half hour with him. And so I really made that connection with him. And we did a breathing practice. And finally, he had shared with me that the night before, his trailer had been robbed. And they took, you know, his mom's money, jewelry, his Xbox, all his games. So it was that moment I really recognized this therapy was important, this occupational therapy work, but our kids don't have the calming skills, the coping skills, these practices that can help them get through really difficult times. And yes, schools have counselors, social workers, but when I spoke with her later in the day, she said, I was made aware of the situation that happened last night, but I'll get to him later. I've got several kids before him. And it was kind of that moment I realized teachers are at the forefront of all of this. Therapists, you know, all staff really, but do we have the skills to be able to teach, you know, these mindfulness practices to kids so that they can cope and navigate their inner world? Because if they can't navigate the inner world, it's really challenging to navigate the outer world.
You told me you've been able to apply this personally too. What have you noticed when you look at yourself? And how does it tie into education?
Yeah, so I was never diagnosed, but I was a kid who probably would have been diagnosed with sensory processing. I was a very sensitive child, light, sound, all of that. My parents used to make a bet, how many minutes until Heidi comes home crying from the park? You could look at me the wrong way and I would cry. So I was a very emotional child. But, you know, kids have big feelings. Adults have big feelings. And we've never really been taught how to process that, right? So this whole social and emotional piece to me is foundational in education. And so for me, when I started my yoga practice, I found this sense of deep inner peace, and it wasn't from the poses and the physical side of it. It was the last 5 minutes, Shavasana. I loved the ending. I loved, you know, the calming part of that. And so when I started my meditation practice, what I found was I was able to befriend myself for the first time, you know, all the parts. And I think if kids can do that, we would see a completely different world. And so for me, it was subtle at first. I was sleeping better. I noticed my relationships were more harmonious, communication. I felt very present with people. And so this trickled out into my life and I thought, okay, now I want to teach my kids. Now I want to teach everybody else's kids. Now I want to teach teachers. Because as much as I love the one-on-one work with students and in classrooms, if teachers don't have these skills and these tools, I mean, children mirror the nervous systems of the adults around them. So if you have a stressed out teacher, you're likely going to have, you know, a stressed out classroom. And that's, I mean, owning it is the first thing. I knew oftentimes when my temper would flare, it was my voice. I would shout, you know, where now I just get really quiet and I get close to my kids and I look them in the eye and I tell them, go clean their, you know, go clean your room. And it's almost scary to them, but we can change. We have the ability to adapt and change and kind of notice these triggers, notice, you know, where our emotional reactivity is and then work with that. And there's no shame around it. You know, and really that's what mindfulness teaches, is this present moment awareness with non-judgment and curiosity. So can we stay curious? Can we stay out of that place of judgment and work through things?
You touched on this already, but why is mindfulness important for educators?
Yeah, that's a big question. So as a child, I would spend 7 to 8 hours a day with another human being, right? It wasn't my mom. It wasn't my dad. So that person, I mean, they have such a huge impact on you. And I can remember the most challenging year of school for me, and it was fourth grade, and it was with a teacher who I know now was deeply unhappy, was going through a lot of stress in her own life. And I remember my favorite teacher, who was always looking on the bright side of things and helping me to navigate my personal life just as much as she was trying to teach me about marketing. And so I really feel like, you know, with the stats that exist, 40% of teachers quit after 5 years. That tells me we have a high turnover rate, we have high burnout. It's a highly stressful job. I mean, you're managing 25 little people or, you know, teens, whatever, and they've got their own stuff going on. And so when we pull back and really look at the foundation of education, we're working not only to educate these kids, but also to teach them these lifelong coping skills that they can use out in the world someday. So you can be the smartest, most brilliant person, but when you go through a difficult time in your life and you don't have the skills to navigate that, you know, what are we really truly telling kids? So, yeah, to me, it's foundational.
Let's talk about what we're up against. You mentioned a few things already about teacher burnout, depression, anxiety. That's whether you're talking about a teacher, parent, or students. That's a lot right there.
Yep, suicide is on the rise. I mean, to me, these are all neon signs pointing at our kids, like the rising number of teen suicides with young men. There's something we're missing here when a child doesn't want to live anymore. I mean, so these protective factors we can build in, these supports within the school system, I think we need to start looking at. And I'm excited to be partnering with a psychologist soon to offer skill-based classes in high schools to offer kids a way to, you know, work through stress. What does that look like? And a place, a safe place, you know, if that counselor is busy that day or can, you know, can't get you in until later, or, you know, I just feel like there's things we can be looking at and doing to address that. And our kids are talking. We just need to look at the numbers. They're speaking to us through those numbers. And so if the old ways aren't working, why wouldn't we try something that has been proven to work, that has been proven to help kids, you know, sleep better, feel better? And it's quite simple, really. It's 5 minutes a day, but done consistently, we start to see these subtle changes and these subtle shifts.
So we've looked at the issues. We've talked about mindfulness a little bit. Let's talk about those subtle changes, how the brain changes, and how that can change our thoughts and behaviors.
Yeah, so I mentioned, you know, kids mirror the nervous systems of the adults around them. And so when we look at the brain, and that's really where a lot of my work comes from, is I teach about the brain, I teach about the nervous system, and the breath ultimately is a tool that we have with us wherever we go. So when I teach kids about the brain, I just hold up my hand like this, and the thumb goes in the center and the four fingers around the top. And so the prefrontal cortex, I call it the wise old owl of the brain. This is where we make our wise decisions. This is where we can kind of see the big picture of things. We can get up on the balcony, in a sense, and kind of assess what's happening. We've heard people say, yeah, he totally flipped his lid. That's actually what happens when we're stressed. So when that fight or flight response kicks in, we actually flip our lid, and that prefrontal cortex is offline, which is our emotional brain then at the center, the amygdala. So when we feel stress, when we have that rapid heart rate, when we have that rapid breath, that's what's happening in our bodies. So cortisol starts pumping, adrenaline starts pumping. And with the mindfulness practices, what we're ultimately trying to do is teach that body awareness and breath awareness. So if you know when you're stressed out that you're breathing right here, which 90% of people typically do, it's that anxious chest breathing, we can take a mindfulness practice and a breathing tool, take 2 minutes, and we can ultimately change how we feel just by breathing. And I know it sounds silly, but one of the student athletes I work with, She called me this morning and she said, Heidi, I did my breathing and I feel so much better. And so we know when we're calm, we can focus. When we can focus, we can learn. And that's the ultimate goal, is to change how we feel. But first, we have to recognize what's going on so we can teach about the brain and the body. And it's crazy. Our ancestors used to have two fight or flight episodes per week. And this is like running from a tiger to stay alive, right? Now, post-industrial time, we have 52. And that could mean, you know, a pop quiz. That same stress response is happening in the body as if we were being chased, right? So if we know this, we can work with it, but we have to practice. And that's why it's called a mindfulness practice. You know, there's a lot of mindfulness happening right now. You know, people are throwing it out there. And my goal and what I'm hoping to do is to have teachers practice just 5 minutes a day with their students. And it can be fun. You know, there's formal practices of sitting and breathing, but we could even go outside and, you know, look for five beautiful things, listen for four sounds, three sensations on our skin. So it's really just body awareness and then using the natural world to be present and to check in with where we're at and what we're doing.
You mentioned kids mirror the nervous systems of adults around them. That's a really important statement.
It's huge. Think about that for a moment. When I was a child, I learned how to stress through my parents. I had an extremely calm mom to the point where like nothing really razzled her. To this day, she is so chill. My dad, on the other hand, and now I'm realizing why she was the way she was, is just kind of, you know, a little more hyper, and he talks loud and he's all over the place. So I learned kind of two ways. You know, I learned this calmness from my mom, but also I get really excited about life too, you know. So think about the teachers that we have in our lives and the adults and our mentors. When things are stressful for adults, kids pick up on that. They're so smart. They're so wise. I mean, they really do pick up our mannerisms. They pick up, you know, our stress ultimately. So we have a big responsibility as adults and as people, you know, teaching kids and as parents to really check in with ourselves and to take the steps necessary to kind of figure that out for ourselves, right? Our triggers. I go through that in the training. I have teachers talk about their triggers. It could be loud noises. It could be, you know, that one kid that when they walk in the classroom, they're like, oh, he knows how to push my buttons. And we go through a process of, you know, different practices that we can use to recognize that and then work with that. And to me, that's the ultimate form of self-care, being good with what's going on in here so we can do the work that we're here to do out in the world and to be sustainable. I mean, 40% of teachers after 5 years, I mean, that's not sustainable.
So all that being said, there's a long way to go, but schools have started seeing some success, right? You mentioned that. Let's hear about a couple of success stories.
So I partnered with a woman 2 weeks ago for a festival in Minot called LIWOC, and it brings awareness to the stigma of mental health and suicide. And she's just an incredible woman who is doing some things in inner city schools, like the toughest schools, I would think. And what they're seeing is incredible. They have transformed a detention room into a mindfulness space. So after school, if you've been served detention, instead of going there to sit as a punishment, they actually teach the kids these coping skills. And it's brilliant because what they're doing is giving them some skills-based options, right? So next time you get mad and you decide to get into a fight or push somebody, instead of doing that, what we're trying to teach is how to respond rather than react, because ultimately that's what we're doing. When we flip our lids again, that amygdala, that emotional brain kicks in and we react. So there's schools that even in Bismarck, Rita Murphy, for example, there's two teachers there that have done some really incredible work. And I went and I observed one morning, these kids, it was a second grade classroom. It was incredible. It was incredible. So we sat in circle and they went around the room and 22 kids shared a different tool with me that they love to use when they feel stressed or nervous or anxious or somebody says something mean to them. So 22 different kids shared a different tool. I mean, it was just incredible. And one little boy interrupted another girl during her sharing. And she said, excuse me, Isaac, I wasn't finished. And he apologized and they continued. And these little people, I mean, that's a superpower. I would love to see more adults practicing that, like not interrupting and this conscious communication. So there is hope and there are schools that are using it and they're seeing incredible results. But for me, it starts with us, our own practice, right? Teachers and adults embodying that. And then, you know, once you have the adults that are on board and they're practicing that, then we share that with the kids. And then ultimately, once we've integrated that into the classroom, you've ultimately changed the culture of a school.
Seems like our teachers are really hungry for this content.
Yeah, I'm not surprised because I observe people and I pay attention and I see how everybody's running around with their heads cut off. You know, it's incredible. So when you hear self-care and when you hear stress management and when you look at some of the things I teach, you know, relaxation, breath work, we incorporate a little bit of mindful movement or yoga. If there's ways that we can do simple practices throughout our day to ultimately feel a little bit better, why wouldn't you want that? So, yeah, I'm not surprised. I'm excited, actually. I'm excited that teachers are coming forth and demanding this and saying, you know, there's things we can do to change. And really, you know, when teachers feel better, the students feel better.
That's Heidi DeMars talking with Tom Gerhardt. The Cutting Ed podcast is a collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Denter-Smith. It is 5K Giving Day. You've heard me say that a few times on Main Street today because we're taking advantage of this Tuesday and a $5,000 gift that makes this match possible thanks to M. Jean Fisher. And we thank her very much for her support of Prairie Public and Main Street. And this is your opportunity to leverage that $5,000 to double your gift. This is a very good deal if you like Main Street. And, of course, we hope you do because this is our job. And we like to think it's a job worth doing. The interviews you hear here, the special program content you hear here is made possible by members. Listeners, we always say we love the fact that people listen, but the fact is people can listen because there are members that make it possible. Listener contributions that make quality, locally produced shows like Main Street get on the air. It's easy to take advantage of that 5,000, that 5K Giving Day opportunity. Just give us a call toll-free at 800-359-4145 or go online, prairiepublic.org, and click donate. Or text the word support to 484848 and click on the link we send. And if you come in at $15 a month, just a suggestion here, whatever you want to give is, of course, appreciated, that will net Prairie Public an additional $180. That's 15 times 12, $180. Then M. Jean Fisher's match makes that another $180. And we're going to send you the popular navy blue Prairie Public winter beanie hat in time for Christmas. Isn't that a cheerful way to look at 5K Giving Day? Make that call or go online or text that support right now. Dakota Datebook is next.
I'm Karen Duffin from Planet Money, and recently we were at this yard sale in Tennessee where we tried to buy a Pretenders record, but the owner decided he did not want to sell it. In economics, this is called the endowment effect, which basically means as soon as you own something, it becomes more valuable to you. And public radio is already important to you, so make it even more valuable. Give a year-end gift now. Here's how.
Just call 800-359-4145, go to PrairiePublic.org, or make your year-end tax-deductible gift by texting the word SUPPORT to 484848 and click on the link.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 11th. Bismarck High School is a very historic building, having been constructed in 1935, in hard times of the Depression. The three-story structure has distinctive Art Deco architecture with vertical decorative lines cut into stone along the doorways and between the rows of windows, simple yet stylish. The architect was Robert A. Ritterbusch, a native of Oaks and a 1917 architectural graduate of what is now called the University of Cincinnati. Ritterbusch instilled beauty into the building by including low-relief carvings in stone above the doorways. The west and east entrances feature a symbolic figure of a mother sending her son to school, while the south doorway beheld an image of a pioneer mother accompanied by the engraved words, "The public school, first flower of our frontier, and greatest gift from our pioneer founders." The new high school was considered necessary because Bismarck was growing in population despite the Depression. in part because Bismarck, as the state capital, had expanded services and offices because of New Deal programs. In fact, it was the New Deal program, called the PWA, the Public Works Administration, that provided partial funding for building the school. The total cost was $404,400, with 30% covered by a PWA grant. Bismarck citizens approved a bond issue to cover the rest, minus $85,400 from an existing building fund. Because the school was built during the Depression, labor costs were low, with subsistence wages of 50 cents to $1.20 per hour. Materials such as marble and brass fixtures were of magnificent quality, but there, too, the cost was low due to Depression prices. It was on this date in 1934 that the Bismarck Tribune published an article about laying the cornerstone. Students and school administrators placed 45 items in a copper box, sealed in the cornerstone, that revealed details about the culture of those times, in school, business, and the community in general. So if you get a chance, take a look at the architecture and appreciate the grayish-brown Hebron brick walls, the rose-red Gasota limestone foundation, and the stylish Art Deco lines preserved in Bismarck's historic high school. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
He saw a black man with a gun, and he made his determination that he must be a criminal.
How have police killed black men who had weapons, good guys with guns? One police trainer reports cops say it's a reflex.
It really wasn't a decision for me. It just was a reaction. I don't know if this guy's a good guy or a bad guy.
How to train to make a decision on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Just a couple of minutes left in our 5K Giving Day opportunity for our listeners to become members and take advantage of the M. Jean Fisher Donor Advised Fund $5,000 match. I know that we've gotten pretty close to it, but we haven't got there yet, and this is your opportunity to help us get it over by making that call, 800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org, or texting the word support to 484848, and then clicking on the link that we send to that text. You know, quality programs like All Things Considered, which comes up right after Main Street, or Morning Edition, which starts the morning for so many people who listen to Prairie Public, or those weekend shows like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Well, Main Street's part of that mix as well. And for those of you who are listening right now and have become supporters, I deeply appreciate that because you actually make the show possible. For those of you who have been thinking about it, there's no better time to think about it near the end of the year because everybody's got a budget to make. We do, and you do too. But this is a pretty good way to spend some money to do something very good for yourself and for the other people out there listening today. Only 20 days are left in 2018. Let's make the most of them by supporting the service you're listening to right now. Prairie Public is member-supported radio, and we love our members. Give us a call, 800-359-4145, prairiepublic.org, or text the word support to 484848 and click on that link we send. And come in at $15 a month, make it a $360 gift because it's matched by M. Jean Fisher, and you'll get that blue Prairie Public winter beanie hat in time for Christmas. For those of you who've done it, thank you, and we'll see you tomorrow.